this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
Actually suggested the Culture series to me a couple of years ago, and I ate them up like candy. They are my favorite science fiction books. And this, because the Culture novels are all so long, I think they're all 600 pages or something like that, I decided that perhaps we could start with a novella. And let's see, so it's Ian M. Banks. He used Ian M. Banks for his science fiction and Ian Banks for his straight fiction. And let's see, he died a few years ago, which I find incredibly sad because it means there's no more Culture novels. The Culture is a society. It is within our galaxy. It's within the Milky Way galaxy. And it is post-scarcity. Basically, the people of the Culture presumably developed AI that is robust enough or was robust enough to actually support them in anything that they wanted to do and support their lives. They call them orbitals and also ships to support people, the people of the Culture. And the people of the Culture are from different planets, and the AI are, they're called minds, and they are mostly housed in ships. And we join the ship, the Arbitrary, which is a general contact unit. And contact is, the Culture is kind of an anarchy, but it kind of also has a government. And contact is the arm of the Culture that goes out and looks for new civilizations to decide whether they want to bring them into the Culture or not. And the book that we read, or the novella that we read, The State of the Art, is the only story in the Culture series that deals with Earth. And you never know if the ships are lying or not. I never know if the ships are lying or not.
That's such a fun thing to say. I love that.
Yeah. But they presumably, or, reportedly just happened upon Earth. And it's 1977. And the main character, besides the ship itself, is Dizzy at Sma, call her Dizzy. And she is a contact agent. And they are trying to figure out if they want to bring, the ships are trying to figure out if they want to bring Earth into the Culture. And it's 1977. There's a lot going on Earth. And Dizzy really wants to bring Earth into the Culture, and the ship does not. And one of the other contact agents that has gone down to Earth to live there has, as they say, gone native. People in the Culture get all sorts of additives. They get gland enhancements so that they can take various drugs to calm themselves, to make themselves high, to give themselves better orgasms. Like, all, it runs the gamut. They live generally 400 years. They're strong. They, there's a lot to it that I don't really want to go into right now. But basically, he's gone native, and the story is basically around what is it that would make someone in the Culture, where everything is kind of perfect if you're a human, what would make you feel that you needed to be in a society where suffering played such a large role? And I'll let you guys take it from there.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed this story. My first question, though, was that it's called The State of the Art, and I was wondering if we could get it, what that title is about.
I've already talked enough. Somebody else take it.
I'm trying to find it. I remember a discussion toward the end of the story about art, right? Am I right about that, Mary?
About beauty, right?
Mm-hmm. Was it beauty?
That was a separate discussion, but it related one, I think.
It was near the end of the story, and they were talking about art, and it was actually the first time that I saw that phrase in the story, despite the title.
So, I couldn't really venture, the state of the art, maybe. I was really interested in the main conversations going on between Lintner, and maybe that has something to do with it, kind of like in the last question where you have a moving timeline it's kind of ever present, or whenever you're in that zone, whether you're in 1977, say, or in the future, or when you are talking to a terminal or talking to the next level generation, maybe it's always like to be something, and maybe Lintner enjoys what it's like to be something then over the kind of the dull basal rate that they get in space. I think that's one of the conversations. He says the stakes are higher on Earth. And I don't know what that means, because that also means that it's lying outside of this, not galactic empire, but, you know, this other organization. So it's a little bit wild still. Like, that's the sense that you get. So, like, why would he prefer to essentially, like, the equivalent would be us, like, running off into the woods or something? Or, I mean, it would be crazy to shift gears this much, but he's doing it.
I think that as far as the art part is concerned, yeah, I'm on page 64, but I think it's the same basic thing. It's longer than I'm going to read, but it strikes me that although we occasionally carp about having to suffer and moan about never producing real art and become despondent or try too hard to compensate, we are indulging in our usual trip of synthesizing something to worry about and should really be thanking ourselves that we live the life we do. We may think ourselves parasites, complain about mind-generated tales, and long for genuine feelings, real emotion, but we are missing the point, and indeed making a work of art ourselves and imagining such an uncomplicated existence is even possible. We have the best of it. The alternative is something like Earth, where as much as they suffer, for all they burn with pain and confused, bewildered angst, they produce more dross than anything else, soap operas and quiz programs, junk papers and pulp romances. It goes on, but I think that that's the basic idea.
That was Lee, right, saying that?
I think that was Sma, yeah.
Oh, it was
Sma? I mean, she's pissed that Lintner doesn't appreciate what he has. Basically, if you went to anyone on Earth and offered them this deal, they would take it. No one on Earth would turn it down. So it's an insult to everyone. It's an insult to the culture and an insult to the people of Earth to fail to go native.
Let me ask you a question, though, just so I can be clear. If anyone on Earth is offered this deal and anyone on Earth would take it, the deal specifically is that there would be, first of all, they'd live for 400 years. So, you know, some form of immortality, right? And they have physical prowess, right? There's no suffering, am I right?
Yeah, I think the big idea is that that it's post-scarcity. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to work for a living, basically. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, just thinking it's kind of similar to how there's, you know, hunter-gatherer tribes in the Amazons that there's great amount of care made to not contact or give them Western technology, which seems kind of immoral on the face of it. But I think the thing that you forget is that there's no going back once you reveal medicines, housing, automobiles. There's no really going back unless, you know, they turn into Luddites.
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments, like, are you sure you know what you're doing? If we interfere, are you sure it's positive? Have we done this enough times to look at it at scale and figure out that it's like coming out net good whenever we intervene, you know? I just found a quote, and I think this has something to do with art, and it's interesting because this is what affected. Anyway, this is at this is section 3.2, and it's the very beginning of just another victim of the ambient morality. He says, I came out stunned. I was angry at them then, angry at them for surprising me, touching me like that. Of course, I was angry at their stupidity, their manic barbarity, their unthinking animal obedience, their appalling cruelty, everything that the memorial evoked. But what really hit me was that these people could create something that spoke so eloquently of their own ghastly actions, that they could fashion a work so humanly redolent of their own inhumanity. I hadn't thought them capable of that for all the things I'd read and seen, and I didn't like to be surprised. You know, so there's something extra about coming down and interacting. Like, there's something to going native. I mean, this is kind of like a Kurt situation, except not as, except the positive end of it.
You mean Kurt's from
Apocalypse Now?
Oh, I thought you said Kirk.
Part of Darkness.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't misspeak. I was talking about the Starship Enterprise.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
No, I'm kidding.
It's like him coming down for the Gorn.
Yeah, sure. I get that reference.
No, that's a good connection there, I think, Nathan.
Well, it's like one of the things he says is, quote, they have hope. The culture has statistics. That's what Lintner says, one of the things he says.
I also feel that you have to give something to, if you're in a society, if you live in a world where there is no scarcity, then everything that you do is something from you. There is no problem with exchange. So it has to come from within. Every time I hear people talk about, you know, how suffering is good for you, it just makes me want to scream, or that we need to suffer. We have to suffer because there is suffering in our lives, but no one can ever tell me that people are happier because of suffering. They may have developed X, Y, or Z characteristics because of suffering, but the idea that we need suffering, I think, is some really horrifying Judeo-Christian bullshit that we buy and we shouldn't.
Wait, that makes me think of this other quote that he says here. He says, the culture is too certain, too organized and stifled. We've choked the life out of life. Nothing's left to chance. Take the chance out of things going wrong out of life and it stops being life. Don't you see? That's something Littner said. So I agree with what you're saying about quote unquote suffering. But if you take chance out, obviously you're taking suffering out. But if you're taking suffering out, then you're taking hope out. And if you're taking hope out, you're taking happiness or elation or peace out.
I'm not that dualistic. I don't think that that's true.
I'm not saying that duality is not the way to go. It's very sort of religious duality. But I'm just saying that's what he said. And I'm just following what he said. He went with God, right? There was that whole God thing, right?
The Jesus thing.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of freaked me out. It was like, oh my God.
It's training to be a priest. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting about the story, and this, when I was asking about the title, this was kind of what I had in mind, was that it might be because I haven't read enough of the culture stuff to know, but I really liked that. So you've got these different perspectives on Earth embodied in the different characters. You've got Lee's perspective, and then you've got the ship, and you've got Smaw, and you've got Linter. And, you know, there are little vignettes here and there about other characters briefly, but I couldn't tell which the author was putting forward. And it may be because I haven't read enough of his stuff, but I felt like there was a good sort of smorgasbord here of different ways you could look at it without really feeling like you were being beat over the head with this is the right way to think about it.
I also, I like that Lee is such an idiot. Like, you can be in the culture. You can even be a contact agent while being an idiot. That's how free it is. That's how open it is. They have room for everyone.
His running for captain. His running for captain was so funny. So funny. And I guess that reminded me of when they talked about, you know, what does the culture stand for, the laws, and they mentioned that, you know, there are no laws per se, but, you know.
In the other books, there's a lot more to it. It's a fascinating world.
What is the culture ships called, Mary? Like the mind or the overmind or?
It's a mind. His name is arbitrary. They name themselves. I think that there's a part in here that talks about various ship
names.
I'm looking at it right now.
It's so, they're so funny.
Cantankerous, only slightly bent. I thought he was with you. Space monster. A series of unlikely explanations. Big sexy beast. Never talk to strangers. It'll be over by Christmas. Bracketed off. *3*3. That's a footnote. Funny. It worked last time. Boo. Ultimate ship the second, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, I love that. I thought it was a few. It's probably my favorite.
Every book has a bunch of ship names that make me screech. They're really funny.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
But they're taken as individual intelligence, right? They're taken as individual personalities. And they even talk about how there's the technologies there to get Lintner, zap him off the planet, bring him back to the ship if they wanted to, but it would almost be embarrassing in front of the other ships that they have to resort to physical means rather than mental. What I was saying is that, you know, the minder culture thinks that humans should have their own agency. They have kind of radical uncertainty, you know, despite their intelligence and their troves of knowledge. At one point, they say they don't know what's going to happen to a pool ball after it hits five other balls. So they're not willing to make the judgment call to change humanity, where Small wants to because she thinks the culture is obviously progressive, ideal. Lee's just kind of crazy, and I couldn't quite make out his opinion because he decides he should, you know, we should destroy the Earth, and I couldn't really figure out why. And of course, Lintner falls in love.
Yeah, Lee to me was an interesting character because, like, I just found it really amusing that he's running for captain of the arbitrary, right? That play on words there was amusing.
Yeah.
Well, also, how could you captain a ship that is infinitely smarter than you and can do everything infinitely faster, you know, ad nauseum. So yeah, that was, I thought that part was funny. And I thought the part, I thought it was incredibly awkward when he was talking about how Earth was boring. Like I couldn't figure out what he thought was boring or if he was just trying to be absurd, because everything that he said was boring was obviously not boring.
Wait, you're saying that Chip said that?
No, Lee talked about how boring, he talked to Smott at one point about how boring Earth is. I couldn't figure out if he was, it was just like a little petulant snit because they wouldn't let him go to, they wouldn't let him go on planet.
I like that the ship had all this knowledge, but it couldn't convince someone, and it had to like convince someone else. Like it had to play pawn, or you know, move chess pieces around rather than actually intervene.
Well, she says though that it's never clear really what the ship wants, and there's a sort of Matrix dynamic here a little bit that's alluded to, because you know that it's that much smarter than you and capable of manipulation, and she can never tell if it's on the level. So it may be that it gets exactly what it wants. You really don't know sort of when something is that much smarter than you and totally containing you and your culture, whether or not you're doing its will or...
Absolutely. I mean, they're suspicious of the ship. I mean, again, that was just such, that was such a refreshing, you know, notion. Like there was just a lot of things in this that like, so like whenever they go down to Earth, they'd rather remove parts of their bodies or do slight alterations in order to appear human, rather than, you know, like removing the joints of the fingers. And he's like, I got a couple extra toes. And, you know, it was just very interesting, like all these processes. And then like, once they get down there, I kind of wanted to say that, like going back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, the influence of going native. I think the other side is when they grab that tree out and move it back up to the ship, and they say that this kind of stuff happens all the time on these voyages. People kind of appropriate the environments that they're being around. And that's just a kind of space madness in this age.
Back to a little bit earlier, I thought that it was kind of something that we talked about with Erewhon. Just the idea that, you know, we are a technology of the Earth. And for them, whatever their Earth is, so they were a technology of their planet. And the mines are their technology. And it goes forward. Like there are just more and more extrusions that highlight some feature. And the mines are, you know, the extrusion of a human mind. And there's kind of no going back when you've gotten that far. And at the same time, the mines are actually incredibly kind in many ways. It's not, you know, this isn't a, who was that science fiction writer who, not even the science fiction, who's the scientist who keeps saying that the AI are going to kill us?
Stephen Hawking. I remember Laura brought that up in an old conversation.
Well, the mines aren't going to kill the people in the culture. They actually are fascinated by the people in the culture. So it's an, I don't know, it's an interesting thing. I like the idea that there's this kind of, just this movement forward. So culture citizens have been left behind in their, in the technological process. They've done themselves one better, and now they don't have to do that anymore. They've made something that will do everything for them. But once you have that, there's a lot still to do. There's a, you know, there is art. There is, you know, there is everything that you could do. There is love. There's living. Even if you don't have, you know, you can suffer if you want to. I mean, they can set that up for you quite easily. I am just kind of fascinated by the idea that, I mean, I think that this is basic, that what he wanted to talk about was the idea of suffering and why it is we think that suffering is so important.
I think it's interesting how you said humans are a technology of the Earth. Or...
Well, it's just the idea, the Earth extruded us.
It just reminds me of that book we keep mentioning, World Beyond Your Head, as far as how, you know, humanity adapts to the conditions set out to it on Earth, and the culture in a way gets around that. So in a way, the culture allows you to be more of a pure will that doesn't have to take into account your environmental circumstances, because those are just sort of solved for you. And the question of being, you know, can you be a full human being a pure will that doesn't account for surroundings, or doesn't have to anyways.
I thought about that too, Cesare, because there's a part in that book where he mentions something that he calls virtual reality as moral ideal. And he uses the analogy of the Mickey Mouse clubhouse. which he describes as like, you know, it was this old cartoon where the cartoon characters, they're running along and Daffy Duck is running after some treat or something like that. And he's about to run over the cliff and the hand comes out and puts out platforms for him to run across so that he doesn't fall. And then, you know, he's about to run into somebody else and it moves him. And so it's like you've got this device that's sort of creating these barriers and these fail safes every time you're about to make a mistake so that you don't ever know. But what it creates is just like this zone that he gets into where like no friction is ever encountered. So you don't ever accumulate any awareness of what could cause pain or suffering, you know, or, you know, the different dimensions of existence created by that. So you don't recognize them. And I found that. I guess I'm a little bit on the other side of Mary's. I think suffering is crucial and necessary.
I agree.
But I'm willing to entertain, you know, the idea. And I think it's a supremely interesting idea to explore the idea that, you know, post-scarcity world could be a utopia for us or something like that.
What about the possibility that there's actually something beyond, like that going beyond it, actually there is something more there? So without suffering, there's actually something that you go toward that we haven't been yet.
I'm thinking the same thing, is that like we can imagine, you know, odes and poems to pain and suffering, but we can't imagine what it would be like in this place where, well, it's just better, it seems.
Yeah, you had to... Oh, I thought it was interesting. And I wonder, so Mary, you sent out that Wikipedia about the broader stuff of the culture, and I was looking at it and I wondered if you said you disagreed with some of it. And I wondered if the line you disagreed with was the part where somebody was describing that he had deliberately set up the AIs presupposing that they would be good and benevolent, which allowed, you know, was the sort of crucial presupposition that allowed the anarchist culture to be benevolent, because if they had been open to corruption, then they would have, you know, it would have sort of put a chink in the whole thing. Trying to find the line here.
Honestly, it's interesting. I don't remember what it was that
I didn't. He says, investing all power in individualistics, the danger involved in this imaginative step is clear, though. One of the problems, with the culture novels as novels, is that the central characters, the minds, are too powerful and, to put it bluntly, too good. I wondered if that was the part you sort of disagreed with.
Well, I don't know that the minds actually are too good, because I think that he's actually ambiguous about it in his writing. But I don't remember what it was that the parts that I didn't actually agree with. I did think that it was a good overview.
Can anyone critique the culture in any sense, apart from just the fact that there's a lack of suffering, that it's somewhat sane in how comfortable people are?
Well, you know, you don't see it in this. Well, you see it a little bit in this story, but they meddle, you know, they're not meddling on Earth. Sma wants to meddle, wants to get into it. But in other of the books, they act, you know, if there is a society that's incredibly oppressive, they will go in. They will sometimes go in and smack it down. That's when there is a level beyond contact. I think it's called special circumstances is the unit. And Sma eventually works. So one thing about the culture book novels is that none of the characters carry across. Some of the books happen 10,000 years later from the previous one. You don't have to read them in order. There is one war. The first book takes place during a war that they're in. And one of the later books deals with the consequences of that war centuries later.
Yeah, there's this bit here where it says, this is just that interaction where they're talking about the locals and intervening. They said they're doing what they normally did, murdering and starving and dying and maiming and torturing and lying and so on. Pretty much business as usual, in fact. And it bothered the hell out of me. But I was still hoping we'd decide to interfere and stop most of that shit. Like, I think that that's a really, I just think that that was the first time that I kind of like swung in behind our main character. It was just, it was sympathetic and it seemed possible, at least in this universe, you know, the way things were set up, that was hopeful. That was what you would imagine. That's as good as you'd want to be that good. Or it seemed like if nothing else is that good, at least there's that aspiration here.
I love that the drone gave the chapters names because the chapter names are a lot like the ship name. You know, the drone is just an offshoot of a mine. Sma didn't name the chapters. This is just all a letter, basically, to the guy who she's writing to about what happened 100 years later. And she dictated it to a drone, and the drone separated out chapters and gave the chapters titles. And I think that the chapter titles could be ship names, like 2.3 Unwitting Accomplice. That's a great ship name. So I just thought that part was funny. So when it comes to the interference part, there is something that I think is very normal for us to look at and say it would be right for them to interfere. And we actually, you know, we bring our own morality to that. And I think that that is also part of Banks's commentary in writing these books, is that we think we know so well from A to Z when it comes to interfering. I don't know about where you live, but just, you know, walking down the street in most cities in California, God forbid you did something like yell at your child, half the people on the street are going to come over and tell you exactly what's wrong with your parenting techniques. And it's all their morality and what they think is the right thing to do. And, you know, right now, going through the election cycle, obviously we have it in spades. And who's right? And whose right is it to actually decide? So I'm kind of fascinated by that aspect of it also. Yes, I would love to live in the culture because, yeah, I agree with the basic morality of the minds. But that doesn't mean that it's right for everything in the galaxy, for everyone in the galaxy. It really presumes a lot. And I think that a lot of this for Banks was commentary on, you know, especially the UK, their intervention policies, and the culture intervenes. And in this case, the minds are actually backing out. They're actually saying no. But Sma, who is much probably like all of us as far as her morality is concerned, looks at the Earth and says, look at the potential, and now look at how they're destroying themselves. We have to do something. And the minds are actually stepping back and saying, no, let's give it another couple hundred thousand years and, you know, 100 or 1,000 years and see how they do. But she wants to step in and stop us, save us from ourselves. And then, so what are, if you do take a step back and look, what actually are you saving? Are you saving people from? And how do you decide what morality should be outside of your own culture?
Yeah, I don't think the minds would have invaded Iraq. Based off a rumor that there's weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. That's the thing I can't, like, they have access to all the knowledge, and all the knowledge that you can, you know, that's quantifiable. They have too much uncertainty in order to make this leap. I mean, it seems kind of crazy. I think there has to be some way to look at structures in society and to judge them and to see if they're making lives better or worse. Even if you do lose some of that suffering and some of that uniqueness that makes humans humans, my morality can't square with the fact that you leave structures in place that result in more suffering. I just thought about years ago, I worked at like the Bay, a clothing store, and it was the first time I was really in contact with a lot of gay people. And they were so cool, and they were so confident, and I talked to them all the time about how they, you know, they live their lives how they want to. But their stories were basically that you don't see the layers and layers and layers of shit that they had to deal with. You know, they're getting name called, they're thinking of suicide, getting beat up. That was behind what they are right now. And it didn't seem as though they thought that was a great trade. You know, having a horrible upbringing in order to now at least be comfortable with the people they are.
Yeah. You know, there are lots of studies that show that people who have happy childhoods have happy adulthoods.
Or what about the harshness study with children who were like told to refuse love? That was like the psychological recommendation in, I don't know, like the 20th century of America, that, you know, hugging your kids too much would cause them whatever, you know, or like the really unethical treatments where they, you know, like make like a mean mommy and a good mommy for, you know, pet monkeys or, you know, and it's like, it adds up. And, you know, yeah, they may be more mean. I mean, I guess if you want to have one strategy of things, which is just throw people into the pit and see, you know, what comes out, that's one way to go about it. I mean, you certainly will make something meaner that way, but that doesn't seem to be what the culture is about.
No, but there is something to not interfering. There is something to keeping your fucking mouth shut.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm looking at this. Yeah. Here on the first page, it says, I thought we agreed that we would go in, that we should do it. It was best for them if we went in. Don't try and cloud the issue. We could do it. We should do it. That's what I think. Yes, said the ship. But even so, there would be technical difficulties given the volatility of the situation. They're on a cusp, a highly heterogeneous but highly connected and stressedly connected civilization. I'm not sure that one approach could encompass the needs of their different systems. I know that like recognition of the complexity of a problem, I think is lacking in a lot of people's engagement. Like you want to go in, but you do need to go in with something that's going to go well.
Well, here the ship goes into even more detail about what Mary was talking about, that you're going to lose something even when you, there's always going to be at least somewhat of a trade-off. He says, all we have ever done is maximize what happens to be considered good at any particular time. Despite what the locals may think, there is nothing intrinsically illogical or impossible about having a genuine functioning utopia, or removing badness without removing goodness, or pain without pleasure, or suffering without excitement. But on the other hand, there's nothing to say that you can always fix things up just the way you want them without running up against the occasional problem. We have removed almost all the bad in our environment, but we have not quite kept all the good. Averaged out, we're still way ahead, but we do have to yield to humans in some fields, and in the end, of course, there is a more interesting environment. Naturally so. Theirs is a more interesting environment. So, I mean, that's even presupposing, you know, whatever their morality happens to be, but he's still admitting that you're going to lose, like, the finer points of the more sort of interesting details of the goods that come in consequence of bads by making that sort of utilitarian calculus. And I think that's right. Like, I'm always bothered by, I guess I'm just not a big fan of utilitarian ethics, but I'm always bothered by this systems approach where human beings become the synecdoche of like this broader system. And that Erewhon sort of, rationale that we were talking about earlier, that humans are the extrusion of this broader Earth, you know, technology, which it itself is, you know, just the branch of this galaxy or whatever, you know, it's like, okay, that's fine. But, you know, any person in your life who you might consider to be an end in and of themselves, you know, your mother, your husband, your wife, your son, that go ahead and weigh them against five other people and come to your determination if you like. But I have a very difficult time thinking in those terms. To me, there comes a point when a person is just an end in and of themselves. And, you know, beyond that, I cannot tell you how to make judgments about, I mean, I just don't, to presume that you have that authority, it's a function of power for one thing. But to even, you know, to then presume, you know, that, you know, once you decide that you have that decision to act, you know, then you're already in very, very shaky territory, I think.
Yeah. On the other side of that, there is, let's say you found the cure for cancer. You, Daniel, you found it. Do you share it? Do you tell people about it? Would it be amoral not to? Well, how about all that suffering that could have happened if you didn't? You know, if you're going to take it out to, like, if you take it out to the ends. So where do you stop when you have something that people would, you know, you would assume that everyone would consider good? I have to say that if money were not the basis for most of our lives, that things would be better. I truly believe that. I mean, I think that that is kind of simplistic. Anyone would believe that. And if I had a way, if I knew I had the answer, I had solved it. Oh, I
sort of how you live your life shapes the person you are, then, you know, anything can't just say, well, I'm not going to change these big things, but we'll keep trying to solve cancer, for instance.
Well, here's one question I had. So once you take sort of basic necessities like, you know, food, clothing, shelter, you know, that kind of stuff out of the equation, you're left with sorts of the things you were talking about earlier, Mary, where like loving and socializing and that kind of thing are what you're left with. Like there are still things to do. But so I'm wondering, so what if a citizen of the culture, you know, is very lonely and is wanting companionship or is wanting sex or something like that and can't find it on their own or just hasn't been able to pull it off on their own? Does the ship then intervene and provide them or set that up for them?
I hope so. You have all the world. I don't know. I think that, you know, on one of the orbitals, 20 billion people can live on an orbital. And I think that if you need help, you get it.
Oh, I think it's important to note that the ship might have one problem, which is that it always keeps you on your feet. So, and not like, you know, shakes things up, but it is constantly telling you what to do. It is like your mind, you know, it is trying to, you know, push you around to go and do things and act on things and follow things up. And it won't usually tell you to do something that you don't want to do because that's fruitless. But if you, you know, but it does want you to do a lot of something and maneuvers you around. And, you know, that pulls you back in with like Linter there. You know, just like all these missions, you know, around the world. And I don't know, I think it's interesting the difference between those two. I'd like to get back to that at some point.
Yeah, but, you know, these people have all chosen to be in contact. If you live in the culture and you don't want to do anything, you don't have to do anything. The ship isn't going to tell you to do anything. That's it. I mean, there's that kind of radical freedom. But, you know, if you want to go and be part of contact, then you've actually made a deal that you're going to go and work with a ship. You know, you're going to work with a mind, you know, on these missions.
So you do have free will. But then Lintner went to Earth and wanted to stay. And that was a problem. Even though the ship eventually agreed to it, it was a problem, right? Initially. Is that free will?
Yeah, well, and the ship's not a determiner either, you know? I mean, it's a part of this free will system, I think. Or not like, there's not free will, I guess. That word jumped out at me. I mean, they're trying to negotiate this universe and adapt and go with it. And they're observing and collecting everything. And
that's something that is hugely valued by human beings, free will.
Well, we're getting to that we've come up against this question before, right, with Dostoevsky. This is what I took to be one of the big themes of his Notes from the Underground, right? Is like, how much freedom are you willing to trade for perfection?
Objective perfection?
Right. You know, for not suffering for it. Because the idea that there is this perfection out there to be achieved, the idea that you can keep making things better and better and better and, you know, get to a point where you're progressively removing suffering from life until there isn't any more or isn't any significant amount. Well, that implies right there a lack of free will, because at a point you're going to reach a place where to deviate from the set course in any way is going to result in less perfection.
Right.
So you've got that choice. There's no getting around it.
Well, I had a different takeaway from Notes in the Underground, and I think that maybe I can tie it back to the story with Linter. Like, maybe this isn't Notes in the Underground. I think that it is, though, where he talks about a perfect machine that could guess your every action and tell you what you're going to do and even tell you that you wouldn't like being told what to do and so on and so forth.
Right.
And my takeaway was that he said that he would rather scream and go raving mad just to spite the machine and prove that he still had free, or that he had agency. I think that may be a word that we could, that I could say I feel more in touch with than free will, because I'm not sure what's exactly hinted at free. But with agency anyway, I think that's what happens with Linter. He goes down and that's the thing. The ship has, it can't just tell Linter what to do, or it can, but he doesn't have to listen. And so he's going off on his own. And that's in fact why you need to send an emissary and someone who's reluctant and doesn't even know why they're going, you know, in order to get this conversation going and maybe turn tides.
But an emissary to get him to come back, correct?
Yeah, to not stay there, at least, and to just stay there for thousands of years. Because that's the other gambit. It's like, are you sure that, you know, if you stay here until 2077, 100 years from now, man, what if that's as different as 1977 is to 1877? Think about what you're doing. You are going to lose yourself here.
And if you have to go to the hospital.
Yeah, you go to the hospital and they're going to dig out your guts and then they're going to start testing on you and then they will not stop. And they were going to, and he's like, yes, that probably would happen if that happened, but that's not likely to happen. And honestly, I don't know if this is what I want to do. I may change my mind. He admits that.
But the ship does let him stay. Remember?
It must. It's outside of its jurisdiction, or it wants to let him.
So then there is sort of an ultimate individual agency or free will, for lack of a better term, that exists.
Yeah, what I gathered was that it sees it as a drastic option. So it wants to make very, very sure that that's his, it wants to give him every opportunity, you know, before it accepts his decision. But what I saw you kind of getting at, Nathan, was that we might have competing drives, sort of in a Freudian sense, that there are two different things we want. You know, we want perfection and we want autonomy, and that even if they're incompatible, we just have this desire for both of these things. So,
and it could cause a tension because you would be failing one the other.
Yeah, but if you only could have one.
Yeah, I guess in the sense of what you're saying, that if you only consider free will to be making rational choices, then it really cordons off a lot of human action. The same sense that you would say a person addicted to crack isn't carrying out their free will by doing crack as a, you know, they're not making a rational choice. And that's kind of what you lose in the culture, that you're always having to be making rational choices. There's a shrinking your potential.
Again, I think that it's part of our makeup that we assume a morality that I don't know that we should actually assume. You know, unless you get out to the edge cases, it's pretty hard to say. Sure, murder. Okay. But, you know, do you want to talk about abortion? Like, you know, so there's all sorts of moral dilemmas. And if you are, I think that that's one of the main points, is that if you're going to make these big choices, you better be really fucking sure that you're making the right choice.
Well, it's actually very timely, I think. I mean, I've talked about this before on some discussions, and I don't know if you guys have read anything by like Cass Sunstein or, you know, any of these guys who are into, you know, there's a revival in social engineering going on right now where people building digital systems are saying, we have a failing democracy and people aren't participating. And besides that, which I think is correct, there's more decisions to be made in a society this complex than people can pay attention to. So what we can do is we can set up situations, what he calls nudges, where you have sort of technical systems that engineer people to either avoid bad choices or to be more inclined to good ones. So you can make certain things opt out instead of opt in, or the other way around. You know, you can create turnstiles that you can't jump over. You can do all kinds of things. And so we can make people not have to make certain choices. But then you have that same problem about authority, and
yeah,
and that can run from very small sort of social situations to very large ones.
Massive ones. That's scary.
Another version of rule by technocrats, right?
Yeah, but he has a point. I don't want to be unsympathetic.
Is that any better that we're worse than fucking campus carry laws?
Yeah. Well, it's paternalism either way, right? I mean, it's sort of, and that's true. I mean, as a politician, you know, when you're talking about how do we take these lofty philosophical ideas and actually put them into practice, you do have to make those hard choices and say, you know, okay, well, you've got to make some utilitarian judgment a little bit. You got to say, well, what's going to cause the most harm?
And then do that.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, this campus carry thing just completely, I don't know where I've been, but it completely threw me for a loop. I was like, really? But I won't go into it now. But yeah, crazy.
I thought that's been a law in Utah for years now, hasn't it? I remember when I was going to university, we talked about that.
I thought it was only Texas and Georgia. So yeah, I'm.
Well, and I think the thing about this new, I mean, I guess technology is kind of the purview of this. But I mean, the thing is that we're seeing things that we didn't see for 20 years now, fresh. You know, or something that's been, there's like a latency that's catching up with now, like reports and data and things coming to light. And people are seeing like weird old laws more and usual practices for decades and all sorts of stuff that make it appear new or appear as if everything's been going on like that. Or now we can imagine it, that if we're having problems, that this stuff has been in the works for a while.
That checks are coming due or bills are coming due or something.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen the whip, but we haven't heard the crack yet. I mean, what we're feeling all around us is now we're able to look back and maybe see some of the reasons why we're having this. Well, you know, you see something, this is so off topic. You know, I guess my point is that whenever we have anything that's going to bring national attention now we're focusing on it and we can, well, why is that? And then go back a step and look and then ask why a little bit more and go back. And then we start seeing these systemic things. I mean, I think this is the like going right back to the line I just quoted, like highly connected and stressedly connected. You know, so there is this new tension where we're now learning about things that have been just happening kind of passively. We're seeing, you know, videos of things or, you know, all sorts of, it's, you know, it's like with the Vietnam War, like we didn't used to see it. And then there was a new stress that was associated with the connection of the witnessing of war in a way that had been removed, or except, you know, maybe used to be socialites gathered on the hill of the Civil War, you know, battles just to see how things played out. But
do you think that it's that the election is bringing stuff up even more, or do you think that it's just basically internet technology that's making things obvious now?
I mean, I think that these things are just kind of like in a roil together. I think there's some kind of feedback loop going on. Honestly, I think that the reason that maybe these things are so connected in America is, well, I think that a lot of things that are going on, that we see things through screens or through media so much that we are blurring the two, so that whenever we see political things, we take them to be theatrical or dramatic, or we're having a harder time seeing the separation. And so we see these weird blurred lines between somebody like Trump, who is a, oh man, I didn't want to break, okay, I'm editing all this out. And we're not seeing that it's a completely different discourse, even though the media is presenting it the same way. And also with like all the shootings and stuff, that is police protocol or things that have been happening, or the data that we're seeing, you know, come about. This is just, we're already living in the time of those things that have been happening. You know what I mean? So whenever we look around and we wonder why people are, you know, legitimately afraid of police in different, you know, like neighborhoods, well, we can now see why. And now it's kind of, there's shock, you know, just different, you know, in like rumors and reports and hearing nasty things that people say all the time. It's coming at us in a new way. The thing is, though, is that we're also just used to sending, I'm going to be late 20 minutes by these things. So whenever we get something like the world's on fire through a text, we don't know how to, you know, appropriately engage.
Well, bringing it back to the culture, I'm interested to see how it is. I thought that one thing that might be a problem with this story was when the culture takes in a new world, when they take in new citizens, when they decide to make contact, do they do it when the civilization is so far advanced from ours that there is more homogeneity, or so little advanced that there isn't so much complexity? Because they've taken in a bunch of different cultures. So what is so different about Earth that they would say no?
It's kind of why I think if you ascribe any agency to the culture itself, it would be not, you know, trying to make the universe more oppressive, but sort of feeding on information, contingencies, and what will happen. So I think in a sort of cool sort of way, they're interested to see how the Earth makes sense.
Yeah, it seemed like, well, one of the things I was interested in seeing it as a post-scarcity sort of experiment was that one effect that seemed to have was that they're in this quest for novelty, right? They're in this quest for something that can't be fabricated. I mean, why would someone like Linter go down and want to be a part of a high stakes sort of situation like that? And there was another story sort of in there about like the guy who goes out seeking war or seeking battle, you know, or the people they're trying to perpetually make it more real. And eventually the ship has to intercede because they're getting, they're like actually getting in danger. It puts him down in a real situation and he's actually kind of bored with it because it doesn't, you know, the simulated violence becomes more violent than the real violence, just so we can get the same fix.
Yeah, Nathan, how about those video games?
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. I had too many of them and I had to take them out of my shelf, and I just had them all lined up, and I was looking at all the covers and it was all these serious dark haired men with guns.
Yeah.
You know, like each one of them was the story of Jack, John, Jake. It goes against the government. Get bad, appropriate. And, but certainly, like, you know, I don't know what it is about video games. Some kind of muscle interaction. I don't know. Maybe it's like a way of diffusing primal hunting or something. Mm-hmm.
There is a lot to it. There's a huge story there.
I want to say something, although this kind of freaks me out. I think it's Lintner talking. This is just before, just moments before, remember where Lintner and Smog got attacked in the city in New York? And it says, we started off in the same direction again, came to the corner of 48th Street, turned up that. Cold wind blew around us, scattering papers. What I mean is, you have to have the potential for wrongness there or you can't live. Or you can, but it doesn't mean anything. You can't have the peak without the trough, or light without shade. It's not that you must have evil to have good, but you must have the possibility for evil. That's what the church teaches, you know, Lintner says. That's the choice that man has. He can choose to be good or evil. God doesn't force him to be evil any more than he forces him to be good. The choice is left to man now, as it was to Adam. Only in God is there any real choice of understanding and appreciating free will. the culture gives us so much, but in fact, it only takes things away from us, lobotomizing everybody in it, taking away their choices, their potential for being really good or even slightly bad. So I'm bringing this up as also asking about this concept of utopia, which is obviously what the culture is or the culture is reaching toward, the utopian existence. And is that really, why does utopia have to be like that? Where, you know, I keep thinking of a straight line versus a line that goes up and down and up and down. And, you know, like, you know, when you're looking at an EEG, you know, they're checking out your heart and it's like up and down. And then I think, I'm just saying, why does it have to be like that?
I don't think that it actually does have to be like that. And I don't, and interestingly, I think that, you know, Lintner, I don't think that he's correct. I think that there's actually plenty of evil in the culture. Maybe he hasn't read the rest of the books.
And given that he's citing God, which is very disturbing.
Yeah, and I think he downplayed it right there. Like, maybe it was comical or maybe not, but it was like to be, you know, cut out either the really good or the slightly evil. Like, wouldn't it also be the really evil?
Yeah, but I think that one of the things that, I mean, there's a little bit of an examination of just becoming a zealot. You know, Lee becomes his weird little, you know, he becomes a little bit of a zealot in wanting to be the captain, and the mistakes that he, that, you know, that I think he's making in talking about boredom and things like that with Earth. And I think that, I mean, I'm pretty sure that Ian Banks was anti-religion. And I think that there's a little bit of a play in this. You could take the idea of faith, and that you could take someone who feels that their life lacks meaning, and then feed them something that is, you know, instant meaning, just add water and out comes a zealot. So right. I think that there's that in there too.
I think to go on just to your point, Laura, I think that with the possibility of the evil discussion, I mean, I think it's the way I took that is it's simple as there being more possibilities for action with more options available. So, you know, if there's extreme evil that someone overcomes, then that's a, you know, a wonderfully story. But the problem that you don't see is that with that capacity for evil, there's all the people left by the wayside. It's one of those, I think, discussions as far as, you know, did we have all the wars, the cruelty, death, the suffering and torture to produce, you know, a great person like Shakespeare, or would it have just been better to, you know, kind of be reasonable human beings and have our stories that, you know.
I also wonder, like, maybe there's a real moment in history that is plentiful, you know, in real world history, that maybe this story takes place in a phase of development. I'm not, I can't think of anything specific, but it seems like things used to be fine for hundreds of years, you know, for some civilizations, or things seemed plentiful, or there was like growth of education and literacy rather than decreases, you know, and like lessening of violence. And it seemed like things were going well and people would agree for some time. But who knows what that looked like on the underside. I mean, I'm sure there's a dark side of those histories, and where did all that, you know, good come from? But it seems like it's possible that there could be a plenitude, maybe not eternally, but at least as a moment.
I'm sure you can find a lot of localized examples, maybe not like holistic where everything's better. I mean, I talk about this with my girlfriend sometimes in the sense that she sort of had this assumption that the world is this place that's just getting gradually more progressive and better in a Hegelian type sense. But I mean, you can take a lot of examples, even, you know, there were second the religiosity in the United States. I mean, that's a new phenomenon. I think in the 18th century, there was way less religious zealots than, or sorry, 19th century, there was way less religious, you know, zealots and religious discourse and politics, for instance. I mean, you can look at Afghanistan, and they gave universal suffrage to women before the states did. So there is a lot of local examples, and it just doesn't seem like it has to be a course of history where things end up being sort of more progressive on a structural sense. And I'm not sure where things go wrong, if it's internally that it falls apart, or if it's outside powers that sort of change the dynamic.
It is interesting. I don't, that there's any kind of straight line leading from or to anything seems like a wrong idea. I think it's always pretty squiggly.
Yeah. There's a relativity to suffering too, right? I mean, we in the more developed world, it's not as if we don't have suffering here. And there are types of suffering that you might even want to say are a direct result of our progress, right? I mean, there's a lot of think of like teenagers in affluent communities and suburban areas where there's a kind of manufacturing of suffering there. I mean, I think I experienced it somewhat when I was a kid. It's like you're looking around for an identity and
Right.
I think that it's interesting to look at art, to look at the different artistic movements over time, to see how the world is turning. And that was something you mentioned in the email the other day, Daniel, about having to move away from our fetishistic religious icons and what happens after that. I'll tell you what, this whole de-skilling movement, not my favorite. Not my favorite movement by a long shot.
Is that people getting worse at their abilities?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, the craft is no longer important, apparently.
Well, it's funny how in the de-skilling movement, I don't know anything about it, but it seems like they put an importance on the agency, individual agency, and the ability of you to think and create things out of your own head. And you don't think that necessarily that has to be tied to the actual physical act of creating art. So in a sense, they're on the culture side where they think you should have all the help you can get to create the ideas you have in your head, rather than go through years and years and years of just training how to, you know, turn a brush one way or another.
Well, it's too bad that there's no one to help these de-skilled people now.
Yeah, they don't have the drones like the culture does.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they did. Fill an entire museum with de-skilled dross, as far as I can tell. You know, I love ideas. I do. Big fan of ideas. But I have a hard time getting through. If you can't show me, what you're trying to say, if you don't have the skill to actually let me in on it, then I don't know, write something up on a card and put it next to it or something like that. But if I'm just there with a pile of twine and nothing, what's that? I mean, I know I'm probably showing my age in a really big way, but I really don't get it.
Represents your loneliness. Right? Can you imagine what art would be like in the culture, though? Is that something that's imaginable? We mentioned it before. I think they have a conversation on beauty where Smog tries to say that, you know, beauty is undefinable and sort of disappears as soon as you try to define it.
Well, I think going back to the ship and how it absorbs the other pieces of culture, I don't know that it's completely... I mean, the way they fashion things, I mean, the tree just again, I mean, it was just astounding that they put this in the middle of their... you know, ship. That seemed to be, maybe that's a memorial and not quite artistic, but there did seem to be something artful about the way that people would take on various actions or mannerisms, or they would start expressing themselves based on where they were involved with and what planets they were on and what they were seeing and what they were around. That seemed to be an artistic expression. But I think that maybe that's what the state of the art could be, is some kind of just convolution, or there's so much meaning that people are just expressing what they can with a lot of data. I mean, the ship counts snowflakes. I think that's the other side of it.
Well, it takes snowflakes, collects snowflakes, and doesn't just take a whole bunch. Goes out and finds individual ones. Yeah. At that place where Sma was talking about beauty being indefinable, she was getting pissy with the ship, saying, you're going to say that beauty, you're going to equate beauty to utility. You're going to tell me that beauty has something to do with utility. And I don't believe that. So that was something else. And I think that that's also a difference between the humans and the minds. You know, humans created minds. Minds actually took over and started creating themselves, and it's some form of evolution.
Isn't that why Hawking said he's scared of AIs? Because they're going to start creating themselves and then get rid of us.
The minds aren't going to get rid of the citizens of the culture, but I think that it's interesting that is a complaint. Because if we were to create AI, I would bet the world that we would do it for utility. We wouldn't do it for beauty. We might find beauty in it, but it would be a utility thing. And so it kind of makes sense that if we created minds for utility, that would be the thing that it found beauty in.
Yeah. There's an interesting little line when Lee was going on his tirade for being a captain. He says, you know, he should be a captain because we created AI. And then I think Small retorts with like, well, we came out of some, you know, goo. Should goo control us because, you know, we evolved out of goo?
Yeah, I think that's right. Because, I mean, we have that decision about intervention. I mean, there are a lot of places where we sort of ignore that for the sake of utility, right? I mean, with animals, I mean, there's a lot of cruelty going on in nature. Very few people are interested in trying to intervene in natural ecological cycles for the sake of animal-on-animal cruelty or for the sake of preventing animal-on-animal cruelty. It's usually preventing human on animal cruelty. I mean, that's what, if we're concerned at all, what we're concerned about, but we don't get concerned about the rabbit, you know, or the fox's behavior on behalf of the
Daniel,
rabbit.
Daniel, we've talked about this. I'm very concerned about it.
Well, I'd be interested to know what policy suggestions you have.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's an impossible problem, but you know, I think the lion doesn't really like the kill. It's probably just culture to it. I'd like to think there's a way that we could tend it all away, but it might be a fool's errand, or it might be possibility. That's my sci-fi fantasy, is that somewhere in the future we can, just as we might have come out of brutish nature, we could get everything rising tide.
My greatest fear right now is that we are becoming this thing that's so smitten with our power that we think we have this mandate to intervene in everything. I mean, it's like, I'm just so disappointed with what's become of environmentalism. And I mean, the idea of a non-anthropocentric vision or a non-interventionist vision is just dying away, I think. And we're presuming that we can handle this ecology without nature. And I mean, I do agree that we are doing that anyway, and so we should just take some responsibility for it. But that does have the effect that it sort of gives the green light to intervention in a lot of spheres where we might have tread more cautiously, where we might have tried to limit our impact, which I think was wise. Because I think if our reputation tells us anything, it's that we're not very good at treading lightly. And it just, there's a broader implication there about valuing things just in and of themselves outside of their utility to us or their relationship to us.
Yeah, I mean, mucking it up would be the worst. Going in there and thinking that you're doing something and create a ghetto.
Which is what we've done.
Or, yeah. So, I mean, all of this, like, you know, the engineering things, exactly. I mean, it seemed like a good idea, you know what I mean? And then the application of it actually just, you know, created isolated poverty.
Well, it's even beyond that. It's, you know, looking at it already, because that's that mentality at work. It's, you know, we're going to look at it and we're going to say, is this a ghetto or is this the right way it should be? We're going to go in and we're going to look at everything and we're going to judge it because we know we have the power to change it. And so then already we've set up this framework for let's go around and evaluate the universe and decide what vis-a-vis human beings everything should look like, which is a little frightening to me because I just don't think that we're capable of, or I don't think that we're going to be very good at being that responsible.
No. I'm hoping for the wombat uprising where they come in and they decide how the universe should be based on a wombat.
Are you saying in the sense that as humans, we kind of have ideas which may be extremely problematic, but the way we go forward is saying like, yeah, this is going to be a huge problem, but I bet we could solve it sometime in the future. So let's just go ahead and do it. And you're saying that kind of attitude is a little too cavalier in the sense that like, what is it? 50 years ago, we thought of nuclear power and like, yeah, there's probably going to be some problems in it, but you know, we'll figure it out eventually. And then here we are.
Yeah, I think technology increases human power, but it doesn't really do much about, you know, human judgment. So what we're doing is basically increasing our power all the time without getting any better at using it. So the stakes just keep going up and up and up. So to me, I mean, one simple way to think about it is what can you think about that would save the world? I mean, just tell me something that could save the world and the world would be saved.
Manna from heaven.
I can't think of anything, but can I think of things that would pretty much end the world? Yeah, I can think of all kinds of things that would pretty much put a stop.
Well, it depends on what you think of as the world. I mean, the thing that would save the world would be a really huge drop in population. That would save the world.
Right. Like the ecological world.
Yeah. I mean the world. I mean Earth. And the other thing is that we frequently, and I think because of religion, we don't consider ourselves part of the world, part of Earth. But we are. We are an extrusion of Earth. We're same as trees. If the trees fucked up the world as bad as we did, we would decimate them. We're lucky the trees don't decimate us.
I guess you have to confront the idea of, what is the word? Is it telos? Like, what is the point of it all? Is it just for the earth to be receptacle for life, or are we trying to extrude Shakespeare out of all this crap? Yeah.
Maybe since we already have Shakespeare, we should just call it a day.
Yeah. One of the parts I thought was interesting was Lee's diamond, right?
Oh, yeah.
So he has him, the ship make him this really beautiful diamond. And, you know, it's just one of his demands in his many quests for identity. He decides, you know, he's going to own something. So it makes him this beautiful diamond. And then, you know, it's just like, well, now he's got a diamond. What the hell is he going to do with it? And eventually it just has it discarded and it's like orbiting around Neptune or something like that.
I love that it put it into orbit around Neptune. I thought that was hilarious.
But what do you, I mean, like, why do you stop before you get to humans there? So like, why is a diamond now? I mean, it has no exchange value, but it had exchange value because sooner or later, somewhere down the line, somebody thought that had aesthetic value. It was pretty. We want to wear it. But that was just a sort of reaction that we have. I mean, that was like a sooner or later, you come to that base thing. But why, you know, if like infinite replication has been able to make diamonds valueless, does that not follow for human beings as well or any other life?
Well, I think that the whole idea, you know, the ship was trying to humor Lee, who is an idiot, after Lee was upset about the whole captain thing and came up with, I mean, the captain thing came from being around Earth. You know, Lee wouldn't have thought of it had he not watched a bunch of Star Treks. He started watching, wearing a Star Trek uniform, captain.
Lightsaber.
So he picked up, right. He picked up the human, you know, the earth man, earth person aspects of exchange of value. And he took to betting on races with the ship, and the ship kept losing on purpose and owing him tons of money. But money doesn't mean anything there. I think that Lee was just trying to find a way to relate to Earth. And so, yeah, I'll make you this huge diamond. And it's not that the diamond doesn't have beauty. It's just that it doesn't have value beyond its beauty. It doesn't have monetary value. So it's pointless in one way. And in another way, it's, you know, beautiful and fascinating.
That point to like Lee's trying to stand out amongst his peers there and him not having the means to do so in the culture. Is that a part of that?
It might be.
He's trying to be better, right? He's trying to be not just one of them. He's trying to be Lee the captain, Lee the guy who wins races, Lee the wealthy guy of the diamond. And like, he's stunted at every turn.
Right.
Somebody says he changes his colors faster than something or other. So he's always trying to change into something.
Yeah. And I think that there's also a little bit of him being upset that he isn't allowed to go down to the planet and the rest of them are. And so I think that there's jealousy. And he's always trying to get in Smaz's pants.
I don't remember why. Why is he not allowed to?
I think that it's because he'd have to be changed too much. I think that they said something like, you're a baboon crossed with, I can't remember what, but they'd have to do too much surgery for him to be able to fit in. But even if they could, his personality, he couldn't do it. He couldn't go and not be obviously alien.
Yeah, I think one of his ideas was to set him off on a mountainside, and if he was spotted, then they'd just say he was a Yeti.
He'd say he was a Yeti, right?
When was this book written?
91.
Anybody
know? Yeah.
One of the things that was real different, I thought, you know, in imagining a sort of technological future was that the simulational aspect of our culture and our technology now is kind of missing here in some ways. The major characteristic of our technological milieu now, but it's sort of missing in the culture, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I guess the way you're presented with the Earth is what we see, just glimpses of Paris, London, Oslo, and they just sort of describe the small differences between those places, right?
Yeah, well, and Paris was remarkable because it felt alive, and I think that was the city that was the most affecting, and that's where the memorial was. Did we talk about the memorial? I think we did. Just the touching human culture. I think that was significant.
I liked Lee's criticism or Lee's comments that Small liked the memorial because it was not phallocentric, but vaginal shaped, or however he put it, I forget.
Yeah. That was his Freudian phase.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was also upset that Small wouldn't have sex with him.
I thought,
right.
That, with Lee, you mean?
Go ahead, Lauren.
Because she had sex with Lintner, right?
Well, that's what I was wondering about. When I was asking about, you know, would the ship provide you with companionship or something like that? So it's like, it does all these other things to meet the needs of
you know, the inhabitants of the culture. So I was just wondering, you know, are those kinds of needs fall under that umbrella?
Well, Smod did talk about the ship trying to play matchmaker.
Loved it. Yeah, I made a game of it.
Right.
Thought that it knew best right. How to get people together. Or you don't even know why they want you to go speak with Lintner. You just know that they want you to do it. And you know they're hiding something and you're not quite sure what it is. And when they're not showing their hand. They're not telling you that he wants to stay on the planet. They know they've already tried to talk to him and he wouldn't come out of it. Well, is there anything that we've, just to go back through before we maybe get close to the end, that we wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
I thought that it was interesting, or that it could be interesting. The idea of the culture, it makes the search for meaning, for certainly for some people, even more urgent. The fact that everything is taken care of, I think, for some of the people, actually makes meaning, finding meaning, more necessary. Because you could say, I draw meaning from my work, whatever. I'm an insurance agent. You know, I find meaning through helping people protect their lives, something like that. You could do something like that. You could make that into your meaning if you live, you know, living in a non-post-scarcity world. When everything is taken care of, then really what else is there besides finding meaning? It's one of my favorite things about the culture, is that it's so important.
Well, if there's no one else, then let's go our favorite last lines.
Are we doing final thoughts? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I'm kind of getting at. Yeah, yeah. Let's get to final thoughts then.
For me, I mean, we covered a lot of good stuff. I just, I wanted to say I liked this one a lot, and I enjoyed reading something different than some of the stuff we'd been reading a little bit. Reminded me of a little bit of Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. I haven't read it in ages, but similar sort of thing. Like this guy, you know, he's accidentally left on Mars, and so he comes back, and now he's a Martian man kind of thing, and he's a bit of an ambassador between the Martians and, you know, who are much more developed, and they are trying to decide whether or not Earth needs to be destroyed, but because they live forever and ever and ever, it's going to take them many, 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 many years to decide. So you have a similar sort of dynamic there where it's like this sort of alien culture trying to, you know, make judgments about Earth. And so he, you know, he gets that sort of alien anthropology. I think that's an interesting approach. It provides a lot of opportunities for a clever writer. And this guy was definitely clever. So yeah, there's a lot of good ideas there and a lot of good meat for discussion, obviously.
I'll just mention some last thoughts. Yeah, I really like the book. I really appreciate the suggestion. I never read, hardly ever read science fiction. It was really good, I thought. I'm going to check out the other Ian Banks books for sure. It frustrated me in the sense of the passivity of the culture, not helping the Earth out. It sort of goes against my political views. I guess if you were to describe it, it would be very conservative. They don't want to do anything because doing something will likely screw it up. But then with the culture having so much knowledge at their fingertips, it makes me kind of question how sure I am of opinions I hold, of course, and what I think is so obviously more progressive or better or courses of actions that should take. I thought that was really interesting.
Get a line?
I got a long paragraph, so if someone wants to jump in, go ahead.
Well, I have a line. And I love the story, too. This is from page 37. I had the Word document. It's just one line. Lintner says it. They're real because they live the way they have to. We aren't because we live the way we want to.
Well, I'll throw mine out there. I hadn't read this before. I had read the other culture books, and I love them all. And I really enjoyed this. But I think that the longer ones are easier because you really get into the groove since they're so long. Anyway, so this is toward the end. This is page 53 of my document. Later, Lee had us all play another game, guess the generalization. We each had to think of one word to describe humanity, man, the species. Some people thought it was silly, but on principle, the majority joined in. There were suggestions like precocious, doomed, murderous, inhuman, and frightening. Most of us who'd been on planet must have been falling under the spell of humanity's own propaganda, because we tended to come up with words like inquisitive, ambitious, aggressive, or quick. Lee's own suggestion to describe humanity was mine, but then somebody thought to ask the ship. It complained about being restricted to one word, then pretended to think for a long time, and finally came up with gullible. Gullible, I said. Yeah, said the remote drone. Gullible and bigoted. That's two words, Lee told it. I'm a fucking starship. I'm allowed to cheat. I do think that it's interesting that if you viewed humanity from afar, we would seem horrifying. But up close, we are, you know, astounding, amazing, magnificent, right? That we are, we do have incredible qualities. But from afar, what you would see, I do think that you kind of have to get up right up next to us to see our magnificence.
I didn't mention that, but I was really interested by the way he charted distance through the different perspectives of the characters. And he really drove that point home that down in the flora and fauna, you know, is one perspective, and utilitarian judgment's another perspective, and then just gathering data is another perspective, and each has a sort of ethical connotation built in. So
I got a line sort of along that vein. This is Linter on India. It was beautiful, beautiful. If I'd only had any second thoughts, they vanished there. He looked at me, face suddenly open, intent, his hands outstretched, fingers wide. It's the contrast. He looked away, apparently made less articulate by the vividness of the impression. The highlights, the light, the shade of it all, the squalor and the muck, the cripples and the swollen bellies, the whole poverty that makes the beauty stand out. A single pretty girl in the crowds of Calcutta seems like an impossibly fragile boon. Like a, I mean, you can't believe that the filth and the poverty somehow hasn't contaminated her. It's like a miracle, a revelation. Then you realize that she'll only be like that for a few years, that she'll only live a few decades, then she'll wear and have six kids and wither. The feeling, the realization, the staggering. His voice trailed off and he looked, slightly helplessly, almost vulnerably at me. It was just the point at which to make my most telling, cutting comment, but also just the point at which I could do no such thing.
Wow, yeah, I remember that line. Yeah. I mean, that bit, and I really liked it.
They're arguing about, or the ship is joking with Small about how to deal with Earth. And it says it's going to nuke it. And she tells it to be serious. And it says, I'm being serious. What's one more meaningless act of violence on that zoo of a planet? It would be appropriate. When in Rome, burn it.
I love that.
Here's mine. The particular stage of communication they're at, combining rapidity and selectivity, usually with something added to the signal and almost always with something missed out, means that what passes for truth often has to travel at the speed of failing memories, changing attitudes, and new generations. There's a bit more I'll read. I like that part the best. But just after that, even when this form of handicap is recognized, all they ever try to do, as a rule, is codify it, manipulate it, tidy it up. Their attempts to filter become part of the noise, and they seem unable to bring any more thought to bear on the matter than that which leads them to try and simplify what can only be understood by coming to terms with its complexity. Right, I said, trying to work out what the ship was talking about.
Nice.
Yeah, I liked that one too.